From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was the ancient world's greatest conquering hero, Macedonian son, king of Greece, emperor of Babylon and Persia, the man who blazed a trail of violence, war, legend, and intrigue across the Middle East and Asia, and forged an empire unlike any the world had ever known. And he did much of it by the age of 26. The towering tale of Alexander the Great is being resurrected tonight as Oliver Stone's $150 million bio-epic Alexander opens on big screens across the country. In the title role, actor Colin Farrell here rallying his troops in a scene depicting Alexander's defeat of the Persians at the Battle of Gaugamela in 331 BC, the same terrain where American soldiers now patrol outside Mosul, Iraq.
Some of you, perhaps myself, will not live to see the sun set over these mountains today. But I say to you, what every warrior has known since the beginning of time, conquer your fear! And I promise you, you will conquer death! When they ask you where you fought so bravely, you will answer, I was here this day at Gaugamela for the freedom and glory of Greece! Zeus be with us!
Alexander the Great was just 32 years old when he died 2,300 years ago in Babylon, modern-day Iraq. Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Egypt, Pakistan, and more, all his. They had different names back then, but history's greatest warrior built an empire in a part of the world that is very present in the minds of Americans right now. Tonight on Point, the first superpower, Alexander the Great. You can join the conversation. St. Augustine said Alexander was driven by a global appetite for plunder. Is it always the same with conquerors? And what can American forces in Iraq and Afghanistan tonight learn from the history of Alexander? About military tactics, about changing a region of the world. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Cambridge, England, is Paul Cartledge, professor of Greek history and chairman of the Faculty of Classics at the University of Cambridge. His latest book is Alexander the Great, The Hunt for a New Past. Good evening and wonderful to have you, Paul Cartledge.
Well, good evening, Tom. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Also joining us tonight from Greenville, North Carolina, Peter Green, distinguished visiting professor of classics and ancient history at East Carolina University and author of Alexander of Macedon, 356 to 323 BC, a historical biography. Peter Green, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine and a bit of a conquering hero himself. Hi, Jack. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Okay, here we've got all these timpani drums and the music of Hollywood going wild with Alexander the Great. Paul Cartledge, I know you haven't seen it yet. We'll talk tonight with a student of Alexander who has. But this is hardly the first time Alexander's been rolled out. He's been rolled out again and again and again through history. Humans can't seem to get enough of this guy.
Now, you're quite right. There's, of course, been another major movie on him almost exactly 50 years ago. But that took a very different line, I believe.
This is Richard Burton's 1956 or so.
Absolutely right. It took a very long time to get him from Greece, where he was born, over to Asia, to the Persian Empire, which he conquered. And I think that the producers of the Stone movie, I'm sure, will want to have him over there a lot quicker and have a lot more action taking place actually in Asia. I've read a synopsis of the movie. I've read a couple of very critical reviews of the movie, but
yes,
you're quite right, I haven't yet seen it.
Well, Peter Green, I wonder, in the little clip we heard there just at the top, and we'll talk plenty about this tonight, but we hear Colin Farrell as Alexander the Great whipping up his men for this great battle in the name of freedom and glory for Greece, he says. Freedom and glory. Were these the great motivators of the great conqueror?
Of this particular great conqueror, no, I don't think they were. The glory, yes, but entirely his own. Freedom, hardly. People were welcome to be free as long as they were free on his terms. But mainly, I think he was a demon-driven character who was after what the what Homer called kleos, fame, glory, and in pursuit of it, he tried to emulate Homer's Achilles that he was always identified with when young.
A demon-driven warrior. Paul Cartledge, we'll talk about that motivation. I wish you'd be good enough to give us the thumbnail history of Alexander for people who haven't studied him or whose history class is so long ago that they've forgotten. His father unified Greece and give it to us in a nutshell. What did this man accomplish in those few years?
In a couple of sentences, he was born in the middle of the 4th century BC, born at the capital of Macedon, of which the king was his father, Philip. His mother was a Greek from northwest Greece, and her name was Olympias. So we have Philip Olympias producing Alexander in 356 BC. Philip at that time was very recently arrived on the throne of Macedon. He had problems much nearer home initially, but by the time he died, or rather was assassinated 23 years later, he had indeed, as you said, conquered mainland Greece. And this was the basis on which he, Philip, was going to go over and take on at least some part of the Persian Empire. We can't be quite sure if he had the idea of conquering all of it, or let alone going as far as Alexander was to go. But at a procession, a wedding procession for his daughter, who was the full sister of Alexander, he was assassinated, and the finger was pointed at Olympias, the finger was pointed at Alexander.
Olympias, that is Alexander's mother and Philip's wife, or queen.
Indeed, and we'll never actually know the truth, of course, of who exactly was behind it. We know who did it, but we don't know what was behind it. But
the movie suggests that Olympias, his mother, wanted him to be the man who built the empire.
Well, this is one line that's present in the sources and is not in itself implausible, but can't be completely demonstrated. That's to say that she was a terrifically powerful woman in her own right, that she fell out with her husband, that she was passionately attached to her son, and that she wished, in a way, to promote herself through her son, and therefore, well, would she stop at nothing? Possibly not. And so, therefore, maybe she was behind the assassination of her, by then, estranged husband. That is a possible scenario.
So Alexander heads east and is never defeated, we read. How did he build this empire? Give us the tale.
Well, he inherited the best army in the Mediterranean, that's to say Philip's. And it contained some of the elements which were absolutely indispensable for taking on an empire and an army such as he was going to face in Asia. And among other things, for example, Philip made his troops carry a great deal of their equipment so that they were relatively traveled light. There wasn't a lot of baggage. And so they were able to march relatively far and fast. They were very self-reliant. The other thing that was key was that Macedon relied for its strike force on cavalry. And this was going to match the major strike force of his Persian opponents, who were also reliant typically on northern Iranian cavalry. So in those ways, Alexander was prepared because he was the son of Philip, because Philip died when he did, and Alexander was able to capitalize on that. He started with the very best sort of background.
Peter Green, pick it up there if you would. As this very young warrior set out to the east across what we now know as Turkey, then Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, what was it about his style of leadership, his military tactics, his vision that brought him such success?
Well, I think there are three things. He was incredibly speedy. He was fast. He could improvise extraordinarily well in a crisis. And he was an immensely original strategist. I mean, the three great major battles he fought were all fought against odds. I mean, at Issus, he fought a reversed front engagement with his lines of communication cut. At Gaugamela, he took on a far bigger army, which was led by armored cavalry, an enormous number of them.
And this the battle near what we now know as Mosul, this the battle where the king of Persia, or emperor of Persia, I'm not sure, opposed him.
That is correct, yes. This was at Gaugamela. We're near modern Erbil in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. near Mosul.
Mm-hmm. And against those odds, he won there, and he kept winning.
Yes, and he kept on winning. Probably his most remarkable battle, tactically and strategically, was the last one he fought against the Indian Raja Porus in driving rain on the Jhelum River. The odds were appalling, and he also had to confront maddened war elephants. And I gather this, amid much criticism, is one thing that Oliver Stone has brought off rather well, the battle against the war elephants, who were rather like the armored tanks of antiquity.
And Paul Cartledge, amazingly, it wasn't until that point when these Macedonian soldiers had ridden and marched across much of the known world in the face of those monsoon rains and war elephants that their spirits began to sag. He, as I read it, was ready to go on in, deep into India, into the Ganges Valley. His generals, his troops, were not. He had a mutiny on his hands, ultimately.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one reason for thinking Alexander was of the view that he should keep going further east was that Alexander seems to have thought that the world, that is the landmass, would end fairly soon, and he'd hit what the Greeks thought of as the engirdling ocean. They saw the world, the inhabited world, as a landmass, and around it, in a sort of circle, was a huge ocean. So Alexander wanted to do things that nobody had ever done before, and by nobody I mean not just no human, but no god or hero. He was going to take on absolutely everybody and be better than the very best. So he wanted to plow on, he wanted to get to ocean, and his troops, as we saw, when they got to the river Hydaspes, they said, this is enough. Sorry, Hyphasis, the Bias today in modern Pakistan,
yes.
In the Punjab, they said, that's enough. And it's said of Alexander that he lost only two battles. In a sense, he was defeated only twice, and both by his own troops. And I agree entirely with the reasons Peter gave for Alexander's enormous success. I just add one factor,
yes.
Which is the morale factor, that despite the setbacks, the outnumberings, the conditions, the terrain, etc., somehow or other he managed at every crucial moment to raise their morale until these two, there was one first in 326, and then a couple of years later where he failed to carry the people with him. But up until then, and otherwise, he was terrifically successful at what Napoleon thought was one of the key determinants of a great general, namely keeping morale high.
Keeping the morale, but he couldn't take them to the ends of the earth, though he wanted desperately to go there himself. He turned around, headed back home, and at age 32... died, not clear why, maybe a fever, we're not sure. But Jack Beatty, down through all these thousands of years, this story comes embroidered with all kinds of legend and myth at this point. But in the middle of it, you cannot miss the unbelievable, the God-sized ambition of this man.
No, and it seems to echo with other such conquerors. I mean, Hitler had similar designs on taking over the world, certainly all of it that he could reach with his troops. And Napoleon seemed to think that had the same scale of ambition. But, you know, you could write the story of all these men and to call it a Greek tragedy and give it a name, hubris. Because inevitably they overreach, inevitably the forces that they're fighting coalesce against them. And we say today, where is the glory of Greece? Well, it's a little country in Europe now, and rather a poor one. Its day has come and gone. And that's what's, I think, frightening, just from the historical point of view, to Americans. You know, we tend to think we're invulnerable, we're invincible, we can pretty much do what we want in the world. So did the Greeks.
Jack, Paul Cartledge, Peter Green, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We are talking tonight about Alexander the Great and his ancient push to empire where American soldiers fight today. You can join the conversation tonight. St. Augustine said Alexander was driven by a global appetite for plunder. Is it always the same with conquerors? Was the conqueror, in this case, a liberator, a bearer of civilization, or just another destroyer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Alexander the Great, the first superpower, you might say. Oliver Stone's big new movie is out today. We're looking at the history, what really went on there, and how the myth grew up in the centuries, in the millennia since then. You can join the conversation tonight. Can we learn something from the man-god, as he thought, who fought more than 2,000 years ago, where U.S. troops fight today? And are there eternal truths in the story of Alexander the Great? Is the age of great conquerors now behind us, or are we still in the thick of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Cambridge, England, by Paul Cartledge, author of Alexander the Great, and Peter Green, visiting professor of classics and ancient history at East Carolina University, author of Alexander the Macedon. Let's hear just a little bit of that moment where Alexander, this is from the movie Alexander, Oliver Stone's movie with Colin Farrell, where his friend, very close friend, we'll hear more about Hephaestion, played by Jared Leto, warns of the dangers of acquiring too much power. Alexander disagrees. He says his empire has liberated the people of the known world.
The generals question your obsession with Darius. They say it was never meant for you to be king of Asia.
Naturally. They want only to return to their homes rich with gold. But I've seen the future, Hephaestion. I've seen it now 1,000 times on 1,000 faces. These people need change.
Some say these Alexandrians have become extensions of Alexander himself. They draw people into the cities so as to make slaves.
But we freed them, Hephaestion, from the Persia where everyone lived as slaves. To free the people of the world. Such would be beyond the glory of Achilles.
Remember the fates of these heroes. They suffered greatly.
Oh, we all suffer. Your father, mine. They all came to the end of their time, and in the end, when it's over, all that matters is what you've done.
There's Colin Farrell and Jared Leto in Oliver Stone's Alexander on the big screens today. We have a guest with us, joining us now, who has seen the movie and knows a bit about Alexander himself. John Previs joins us from Tampa, Florida. He's author of Envy of the Gods, Alexander the Great's Ill-Fated Journey Across Asia. John Previs, thanks for being with us tonight.
Tom, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
So you've seen the movie. We haven't. Tell us about it. Did it work? Did it capture the Alexander you know?
Well, Tom, I just walked out of the film about an hour ago. And I can only tell you that it was a tremendous disappointment. I think it was just riddled with historical inaccuracies. I think chronologically, the errors I counted, I actually took notes during the film, and I counted somewhere about 18 to 20 chronological errors, glaring errors. I was just very disappointed because I feel that what happened is Oliver Stone was not true to the essence of Alexander, the true story of Alexander.
Well, that's what I want to ask about, because, of course, we know historians always walk out of these pictures enraged that about the facts, that Hollywood always mucks with the facts, and that kind of comes with the territory. And the reviewers have not been kind. Newsweek magazine said Alexander will conscript you for a long forced march. Better have an exit strategy. But what about this issue of the essence, John Previs? How do you see the essence of Alexander as Oliver Stone conveys it? Compare it with how you perceive it.
Well, what I perceive, Tom, is that Alexander the Great certainly was a great conqueror. And I think that his undoing and what I try to reflect in my book, I try to look at Alexander from the height of his power at Persepolis through to his decline 7 years later. In my theme was simply that power corrupts. Alexander was a young man. He was very, very young. He had too much money. He had too much power, and he lacked what the ancient Greeks valued, self-control. You know, pan metron ariston, the Greeks used to say, which was moderation in all things. Alexander was I believe, too young and without the mature judgment, and he essentially squandered all that fortune gave him. I think as a general, of course, he's always been regarded as a brilliant strategist. But my own personal opinion is Alexander was successful because of the men around him. I think he had able soldiers. I think he had able commanders around him. And I think he had in Parmenio a very senior advisor who up until he was murdered by Alexander, gave Alexander a very, very good advice.
But the movie here, at least from the clips that we're hearing tonight, describes him as a kind of idealist. He wants to take freedom, liberation to the world.
I mean, to me that was totally absurd. How can Alexander be a man with a dream to liberate the world when in fact all he did was enslave millions? When you look at the record, it's a record of conquest, of wanton destruction, the aggrandizement of wealth. He becomes certainly the richest man in the ancient world, probably 10 times over, and it's other people's money that he's taking. He enslaves millions, certainly millions, not millions, but hundreds of thousands die at his hands, and all for what? As I looked at Alexander, I traced Alexander's route throughout the East, and I said, why? What did he do? He conquered vast amounts of territory.
John Purvis, let me ask you on that front, because you've gone and looked not only at the history, but you traveled in across this terrain in recent years. You've looked
This summer is when I completed my journeys there.
So when you look at the history of Alexander, when you look at the American project today, you've just come from these lands. Are there lessons that the U.S. can, or the U.K., its allies, can be drawing out of this ancient, ancient history, or is it so far from us now that it's not really relevant?
Well, I think that certainly history, from my perspective, history repeats itself. And I think there are definite, very definite lessons that we can learn from Alexander's experience as we find ourselves mired in the Far East. I think both, I believe Professors Green and Cartledge both mentioned the Greek concept of hubris, this arrogance, this overweening sense of pride, this sense of self-importance. And I think what we have to understand is that power is ephemeral. It lasts but a short time, and unless used judiciously, it destroys those who pursue it and consumes those who have it.
John Purvis, thanks so much for your book, Envy of the Gods, and thanks for your first-hand report of the movie just out today. Thanks for being with us.
And Tom, thank you for having me.
John Purvis, author of Envy of the Gods, Alexander the Great's Ill-Fated Journey Across Asia. Paul Cartledge, let me turn to you in Cambridge on this issue of Alexander the Great's ultimate impact on this region. We have a president now who talks about changing the region. I don't know if Alexander really had any goal like that in mind beyond the conquest of the region, but historians do write about the Hellenization of big swaths of the territory that he took.
Yeah, well, I think I'm guilty of that myself, and I'm going to be a bit of a devil's advocate here after
Please.
Hearing what John had to say. Now, I'm not saying that Alexander actually did bring liberation. The Persian Empire was not the monstrous sort of evil empire that perhaps even Alexander and his spin doctors made it out to be. It was relatively tolerant. On the other hand, the Greeks were not entirely acting in bad faith when they thought that a typical Persian subject was a slave, because that actually was something like the word that the Persian great king used, even of some of his highest functionaries, what we would call viceroys. Mm. So for a Greek, being a barbarian Persian and being under the Persian great king was a form of servitude. So I think Alexander's sort of entitled to say that in some sense, he is liberating the subjects of Persia, but in one particular case, he has a better case than in others. That is, the Greeks, there were Greeks, many Greeks, who were subjects of the Persian Empire. And if you go back 100-plus years to the time when the Persians, the boot was on the other foot, the Persians invaded Greece, the Greeks repelled the Persians in the name of freedom. And I think that's quite a sort of legitimate notion, that they did not wish to be under a foreign domination. Well, Alexander did actually liberate those Greeks. Now, what about the rest of them? Well, this is where I think there is a case for saying that we can learn some lessons. Because I think Alexander did have a better idea of the sort of cultures that he was going to encounter than, I fear, my own country and yours has of what's going on in Iraq today.
How would he have had that? We famously and proudly live in a media age where we're supposed to be able to know everything at the touch of a button, at the click of a keyboard. How would Alexander have known better?
Well, in this sense, for example, Persians actually fleeing from great kings in Persia came as refugees to the court of Philip. Already, as a young man, Alexander was in touch with real Persians. Mm-hmm. And his father, I think, introduced a number of changes to his court ceremonial, to modes of riding. He was consciously aping Persian practice, and in some way you could say that he'd already transformed his own kingdom and the adjacent area, what's now Bulgaria, ancient Thrace, into a sort of mini Persian empire. So I think Alexander had a much better idea of what would happen after he'd conquered than President Bush and Mr. Blair had of what would happen after they'd unseated Saddam Hussein.
So much for the information age. Peter Green, let me ask you, Alexander, at least in legend, and set us straight, famously went native, adopted many of the customs, the clothing, inherited with his conquest, the harem of hundreds of women of the king of Persia. And the legend is that this was a problem, that it was a problem with his own Macedonian generals and troops. To what extent did Alexander the Great go native, adopt the culture of his conquered lands, and was that an advantage for him or not?
It's a very real problem. I mean, in one sense, he tried to be all things to all men, and he was too really fiercely solipsistic to do that comfortably. At another angle, he was running out of Macedonians. This was always a problem. The further east he went, he had to leave people behind to run the places he'd left behind.
And increasingly tried to recruit locals to make up his army.
Yes, in the end, he used locals to make up his army. This is absolutely true. And he was not tactful about it. He sent 30,000 young Persians to be trained in Macedonian war methods and drill, etc. And when they came back, they were known, and he called them the successors. And this did not go down at all well with his Macedonian veterans. And also, he did things like try and impose what they call proskynesis, that is, Persian-style prostration, on his Macedonian officer corps. And of course, for the Persians, this was simply a mark of respect. But for the Macedonians and for the Greeks, it was something that only a god was entitled to.
That is to lie down on the floor in front of Alexander, to prostrate themselves, even that kind of a full horizontal salute.
Indeed, yes. I mean, equals were supposed to be able to blow him a kiss. Lesser people did real prostration, yes. And this caused an immense amount of trouble, and worse from his point of view, people made a joke of it.
Even his own personal spin doctor, as Paul Cartledge had it, his personal historian, Callisthenes, if I've got the name correctly.
Absolutely, yes. Callisthenes, in fact, his Greek soul, I think, revolted in the end, and he thought that because he had the support of the Macedonian officer corps, he could put a spoke in the wheel of his boss's idea, and he did, and rather successfully. But he paid a price for it because he was accused of being involved in a rebellion, in a conspiracy, almost certainly untruly, and he was put to death, as Paul very nicely proved from a lot of conflicting evidence, after torture.
But Paul Cartledge, sometimes Alexander's going native is seen as a kind of progressive, enlightened, global citizenship on his part. Did he push civilization forward in some sense, or was he mainly a butcher?
Well, I think, yes, mainly a butcher. He was obviously loading the dice much too far, I think, one way. But on the other hand, to say that he was a great civilizer, he's probably loading it too far the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Alexander, I believe, had both short, medium, and long-term objectives. What the long-term were, well, even he couldn't have very seriously have argued that he knew. But on the other hand, he did distinguish between what you've got to do in the way of pacification after conquest, conquest and how you then rule what you have conquered. And what I think was so significant was that he early on decided, after having defeated the Persian Empire in pitched combat, the major battle at Gaugamela,
yes,
he decided that immediately he must incorporate a major, as senior a Persian person of the old regime as he possibly could. And he picked on a guy called Madzias, and he appointed him as governor, satrap, of Babylonia, one of the two most important provinces of the old Persian Empire.
Essentially Iraq today.
Yeah, absolutely. So he appoints Madzias, and I think this is giving a huge signal, and it's not a signal that every, for example, Macedonian and certainly every Greek will welcome, that a senior Persian can rule actually over them. He can give orders to Greeks and Macedonians. So I think Alexander is being more than just pragmatic. He's actually being slightly visionary here, or you could say he's being pragmatic in a very enlightened way.
Pushing the boundaries of the ancient world, clearly. Let's begin to turn to our callers. Ariel's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Ariel. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I just see a lot of parallels between Alexander the Great and the U.S. actions today with President Bush's presidency.
What do you mean? Do you think the U.S. wants to build an empire in that part of the world? That's not what the stated aim is.
Well, I kind of can see that happening, as we've had so many recent wars in the Middle East. We've just, in my opinion, we've gone in and almost invaded Iraq. And we do that in, quote-unquote, the freedom to kind of free these people.
Right.
And I wonder if this is similar. I see the parallel between Alexander the Great's line, "We fight for freedom and glory," and how we declare this as our reason for going.
Our agenda in the Middle East. Of course, that line given by Oliver Stone to Alexander the Great in the movie, but still, there it is. Let us pick it up. Peter Green, what about, is it possible to compare motives across all these thousands of years when you look at Alexander the Great, when you look at George W. Bush? Do you see any parallels?
Well, it is possible to do it, but I think it's pretty factitious. The circumstances are very different. I think, for one thing, Alexander was virtually on his own in what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, he was not responsible to anybody. He had advisors, and as you said earlier, he had his old general Parmenio, that was really his father Philip's general,
mm-hmm,
whom he got rid of. But ultimately, the ideas were his own. He did not have an advisory board to which, in any sense, he was bounden. He did exactly what he wanted to do in a totally untrammeled way.
It sounds a little bit like President Bush sometimes these days, I must say. Peter Green, Paul Cartledge, Jack Beatty, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Alexander the Great and his ancient push to empire, where American soldiers now fight. You can join the conversation. How would you compare the conquering motives of Alexander and what the U.S. is up to today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Alexander the Great, maybe the first superpower. Oliver Stone's big new movie is out today. You may or may not see it, but the history of this ancient conquering hero is pretty amazing to contemplate. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think? Are there eternal truths in the story of Alexander the Great? And there's this: will anyone alive today be remembered 2,300 years from now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight from Cambridge, England, by Paul Cartledge, and from Greenville, North Carolina, by Peter Green and our own Jack Beatty. Let's hear a little bit more from the film. In this scene, Alexander, played again by Colin Farrell, is in India, or perhaps what's Pakistan today. His wife, Roxanne, and we'll talk about her and about Alexander the Great's sexuality, his wife urges him to return to Babylon, where he will be received, she says, like a king.
I
Marshal.
You lose face. These Indians, they are a low, evil people.
You don't try to understand them.
I try. But this I know, Alexander. In Persia, you are a great king. Here, they hate you. Let us go back to Babylon.
Roxanne, Alexander the Great's wife, there played by Rosario Dawson in Oliver Stone's big new film, Alexander. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Steve is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I was struck by the notion that where Alexander conquered is essentially the modern Islamic world, or much of the modern Islamic world.
Yes, it pretty much follows that outline.
And I know that following Alexander, you had a significant Hellenization of certain parts of that empire. And I just would like to hear the experts maybe speculate on whether there's a Hellenistic element in modern Islamic culture.
It's a great question, and thanks for calling it in, Steve. Paul Cartledge, first to you. Here he comes out of Macedonia and Greece with this Hellenistic culture. He goes right east and south into Egypt. Whether he intended to or not, what was the cultural leave behind of Alexander's conquests?
Immense. I was going to answer a question earlier, which was how conscious was it?
Yes.
Did he aim to do it? Well, I think he certainly aimed that his empire would be Greek at the top. In other words, the lingua franca, the language of administration that would unite this entire mass would be Greek. And so to that extent, he'd already set in process what actually happened, because he died, of course, too young to consolidate a personal empire. And almost as soon as he died, his empire was split into eventually four, to begin with three, eventually four large chunks. But the language of all those four was Greek, the dominant, that is, the high cultural and the administrative language.
And what about the cultures, the societies? What was the imprint? Was there an imprint?
This is tough, because it's not absolutely clear in every case that the culture percolated very far down. In other words, you've got, as Peter said earlier, garrisons which grew into cities. Some of them Alexander was actually personally responsible for founding. Some were founded on places where Alexander would have founded one had he stopped long enough to do so. I mean, take Herat, for example, today. This is originally an Alexandria. Kandahar was originally an Alexandria.
The towns we hear about from Afghanistan every time we turn there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then not only the language, but visual art was decisively affected by the forms that were Greek. These were disseminated through sculptures, especially of Alexander himself, but also through coins. Then the notion of Greek literature, tragedy, which was not a native Oriental form, was actually performed in bits, not in whole, but selected bits, even in Susa, the former administrative capital of the Persian Empire. Greek philosophy gets right down, not just where Alexander stopped in northern India or Pakistan, but it percolates right through the subcontinent to Sri Lanka, Ceylon, so that there is a fusion to some extent. So whether Alexander consciously planned this or not, there's no question but that a certain Hellenization took place in the wake of his conquest.
Even if it was primarily, as you say, at the top of these societies, not necessarily in the grain.
But I'll give you just one cultural example, which has immense impact. I mean, it's stretching it a bit, but nevertheless, I think it's arguable. Mm. Alexandria in Egypt is the most famous of all Alexander's Alexandria foundations.
Yes.
It was in that Alexandria that the Jewish community found itself unable any longer easily to follow their Hebrew scriptures and had their Bible translated into Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we call the Septuagint. Well, that becomes, by, of course, a complex process, the Old Testament to the New Testament of Christianity, which is in Greek. Why is the New Testament in Greek? Because that part of the world was in the shadow of the Seleucid Empire, which was a Greek-speaking empire, so that people from Palestine had their sacred scriptures written in Greek.
And if you pick that up, you can see Alexander is still very much influencing the world today. The translators still go back to that Greek.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not saying Alexander consciously would have envisaged anything like that whatsoever, but that is undoubtedly a legacy of Alexander.
Peter Green, our time is running down, but I don't want to lose a little conversation here about Roxanne, his wife, and about Hephaestion, if I pronounce that correctly, his at least bosom buddy and maybe his lover. What about the private side of Alexander's life and loves?
Oh, Lord, there is so much anachronistic nonsense talked about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all this row going on at the moment about, was he bisexual? If they simply said, did he have sexual relations with both men and women, the answer is obviously yes, and there is ancient evidence to this effect, whatever 25 or 26 lawyers in northern Greece may say. To make him, shall we say, the equivalent of a modern gay or a modern bisexual is extremely misleading. What we have to do is to deal with him in terms of the society that he was in himself. And in that society, having sexual relations with either a woman or a man, or more particularly a boy, was taken for granted and was normal. And the trouble is that we think of it in terms of homosexuality versus heterosexuality, which the ancient world didn't do at all. They did have one very firm caveat, though, and that was the idea of an adult male being the passive partner. This was not accepted. If it happened, it was the target of scorn and mockery. You only have to read the plays of Aristophanes to see this, or a legal brief like the speech against Timarchus.
And so a very different world if we look back there. Jack Beattie, our time has run down too quickly tonight, but it leaves me thinking we have to be very careful looking back through the prism of all those years on a very different culture, a very different man. We can look for eternal truths, but we better be very wary about it.
Yes, but there's awfully good jokes, and this article, Mr. Green's in the New Republic, is full of them. One of them refers to Roxanne of Bactria, and speaking of his strategic necessity, he quotes someone saying he married Roxanne in Bactria to protect his rear.
Well, our 21st century humor reaches right back across the centuries. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure.
Peter Green, with us tonight from Greenville, North Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Paul Cartledge, a professor of Greek history and chairman of the Faculty of Classics at the University of Cambridge, author of Alexander the Great. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, getting back to the true meaning of Thanksgiving. This is On Point. Well, it is the night before Thanksgiving, and all over the country, people are looking forward to feasting on a meal of turkey, stuffing, and fresh-baked pies. Writer Susan Cheever knows the temptation to overdo it on Thanksgiving Day, but this year she says she's going to try to get back to the true meaning of Thanksgiving.
Welcome to the season of excess, which begins tomorrow with turkey and all the trimmings. Thanksgiving is when we eat too much. Christmas is when we spend too much. New Year's Eve is when we drink too much. Where I come from, Thanksgiving is a blood sport, and not just for the unfortunate bird. People who can barely manage to get along with each other during the year are crowded into an overheated room and given too much to drink, or not quite enough to drink, while they snack on stale cocktail mix and wait for dinner. There's plenty to fight about. They can squabble over whether it's okay to watch TV at family gatherings or try to sort out the relative importance of the National Dog Show and the NFL game between the Indianapolis Colts and the Detroit Lions. Everyone is dressed up and uncomfortable. Children are poured into scratchy sweaters or tight blue blazers. Women squeeze their feet into new shoes, and ugly things are said. It's an atmosphere inviting disaster, one which encourages the kind of unforgivable blunders that feel like honest assessments at the time, but fester for the next 12 months. This is the season about which some people joke that alcoholism is a threefold disease: Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. Tomorrow you'll find me in the kitchen, about halfway through the meal, somewhere between the cleared-off remains of the creamed onions and the melting butter in Grandmother's Spode dish that never made it to the table. I'll probably be drinking from the gravy boat by then and greedily eyeing the pumpkin pies with their oozing sugar and flaky crust. If this year is anything like last year, I'll be wondering how I could possibly have eaten so much in such a short time. And why didn't I keep my mouth shut? How could I have reminded my mother of the awful time my father carved the turkey and my boyfriend's half-eaten omelet fell out? What possessed me to criticize my daughter's short skirt? And what was that my brother said about my ex-husband? How many hundreds of yoga classes will I have to take to make up for the huge plate of buttery mashed potatoes I worked my way through in an unsuccessful attempt to anesthetize myself while my internet surfing son recited the top 10 signs that you've eaten too much? By the time he got to number 8, you are responsible for a slight but measurable shift in the Earth's axis, no one else was laughing. How have we gone in a few scant centuries from being starving pilgrims to being a nation of gobbler-gobblers whose main concern this Thanksgiving is getting our hands on a prescription for Acomplia, that new diet pill everyone's talking about that's supposed to block the brain's pleasure centers? When did we change from being a community that was grateful for a single feast to being people who don't feel right unless they're groaning and staggering around and joking about stomach pumps? We've gone from Henry David Thoreau to Frank Perdue, from a few pumpkins lazily dotting an autumn field to a pumpkin industry with its own world capital in Morton, Illinois, and its own lobbyist in Washington, D.C. When did Thanksgiving become Thanksgetting? I think we've confused excess with enjoyment. Instead of going from deprivation to fulfillment, we've proceeded right through satisfaction and on to gluttony. More is our national motto. We've left the idea of enough behind us in history. Because although pie is good and a little more pie is even better, a lot of pie is often dreadful. Too much can be worse than too little. Excess doesn't just block our brain's pleasure centers, it obliterates them. They say that hunger is the best cook. If I am starving, the first bite of food is ambrosia. The second bite is good. But by the time I get to the 15th bite, enjoyment has been replaced by entitlement. So as we roll around tomorrow, gorging and belching, asking for the third serving of dark meat, and trying not to tell Aunt Emily what we really think about her divorce, let's remember what started this whole thing in the first place. To those long-ago pilgrims, the food at their feast tasted like heaven because each bite was precious, each heaping plate a miracle, each healthy family member a reason for gratitude. You know what? That's all still true.
Susan Cheever is a writer and columnist for Newsday. Her latest book is My Name is Bill, Bill Wilson, His Life in the Creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. She lives in New York City. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.